This is the current federal tax developments for the week of August the 3rd, 2020. Current federal tax developments are brought to you each week by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. I'm Ed Zollers, broadcasting again this week from Phoenix, and we're going to talk this week about the IRS getting through a number of projects on regulations that relate to the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. I'm going to concentrate only on one project they finished, but we will talk very, very briefly about the three. And I'm not going to talk about the biggest one. So if you're waiting for that, we'll probably have to push that back at least until next week. And I'll kind of explain the reason how I chose this one. But we do have that. And then we also had the IRS come out late, you know, I should say actually midweek, I guess it was, with some guidance about being able to send in your Form 3115 for automatic changes via fax. In fact, you're supposed to send those in now. The IRS probably has decided that they realistically won't be able to process mail very well in the near future. And so they're going to push this off to the side, have this faxed in, and so they don't get stuck with these sitting in a mailbox somewhere to be dealt with, because if you haven't heard, the IRS is a little bit behind in processing the mail. So we'll talk about all of that stuff this week, but let's get going first and talk just very briefly about the week the IRS had. And it was a very busy week for the IRS dealing with Tax Cuts and Jobs Act regulation projects. These are projects we knew they were going to be finishing up. We thought they were going to be finished up early this year. Obviously, COVID-19 and then the CARES Act got in the way, so these projects kind of got pushed back. The IRS didn't get around to finishing them. They are now apparently getting around to finishing some of these projects they had put off. And we ended up with three, you might even say four, separate packages of regulations that came out this week. Two of them are very, very closely related. And in fact, three of them have these intertwining elements I think we need to look at. We take a look at that. So we'll discuss it here briefly. The big one that came out first was the regulation project for the Section 163J limitations on business interest deductions. You may remember under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, generally, a taxpayer with business is limited to 30% of their adjusted taxable income can be used to claim deductions for interest. So if you had $100,000 of taxable income before interest, you're allowed to take a $30,000 deduction maximum. If you have $50,000 of interest expense for the year, you would end up having to only take the $30,000 deduction and carry the $20,000 forward. This was added as part of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. It was one of the ways that Congress looked at to raise money to pay for some of the breaks they were giving in the TCJA, including the reduction of the corporate rate. So that was one of our trade-offs. Well, the IRS had back in 2018 issued a set of proposed regulations, fairly large set. This week, the IRS actually finalized most of that package. And we're not going to talk about the package in detail this week. I made the decision I need some more time anyway to look at it. And frankly, there weren't a lot of things they changed majorly going from the proposed to the final regulations. Specifically, that 11-step calculation for partnerships is still in the bill, in the regs. The S corporations are still treated differently than partnerships. That was also something they were talking about that's still in the regs. They did give us a simplified method for certain partnerships that don't have complex allocation modes, so you could bypass the 11-step process if your partnership is literally five people that own a single office building. One of them was the promoter who runs everything. The other four are passive investors who basically don't do anything, you know, except give their money and maybe at the end decide if we're going to sell it, they get a vote on that. But otherwise, day-to-day operations are not involved in. And we just split the income 20% each, then we're going to be able to not go through the 11 steps, but just give 20% to each of them, which would have been the result of going through the 11 steps in detail. And the IRS has said, yeah, we kind of understand that we really should have to document all 11 steps. It was a very simple situation. So that was something they gave. The other thing which we will talk about here today is they did not put in that package any sort of relief on the syndicate rule that the AICPA had asked for small partnerships. Rather, they are going to follow the rule, which we will find in the set of regs we will discuss in much more detail today. They also issued a set of proposed regs. These deal with some things that they decided needed some more work in the proposed regs. They also put some issues in here related to the CARES Act special two-year rules on interest. And they also cleaned up some issues related to the syndicate rules in specifically. So there are some proposed regs there that will be cross-referenced in the proposed regulations we're going to talk about next. And that we'll talk about in more detail today. And I should say, and it also had some guidance there on controlled foreign corporations that are involved in this structure. So we, you know, have some issues there, how that will all be done. The package we will talk about this week, and so I'll just mention it briefly here, is they did bring out the regulations for the small business accounting method regulations dealing with the ideas of the cash basis of accounting, whether you have to follow 471A inventory rules, the rules for the UNICAP 263 Cap A, not having to follow those, and also, you know, changing the amount of income for which one could qualify to be a small construction contractor. Half of that test, again, also it didn't change, while the total revenue number changed for that, that gets you out of having to use the tax percentage of completion method. I guess we should probably just call that percentage of completion method now that GAAP kind of has gotten rid of PCM. So we just call it PCM, percentage of completion method. So you get out of that. It does not affect the $2 million or the essentially the other limitations that we have there that talk about the two-year test. So, but we did have that. So we'll talk a bit about that. Then on Friday, they kicked out the proposed regulations on carried interest. You may remember that under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, if you are a service partner in an investment partnership or real estate partnership, you receive a grant of a partnership interest, right? Profits interest only, but that profits interest therefore is going to be allocated to you. The amount of, let's say, capital gains to you will be allocated. The theory being that I'm going to manage this thing, I'm going to be doing management work, but since I don't get a guaranteed payment, all I get allocated is a share of the capital gains and other income, that a chunk of my income will be long-term capital gain subject to a lower rate. Under the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, those long-term capital gains are modified, essentially causing you to look inside the partnership for a three-year holding period. Those regulations, we knew already, they were going to tell us that putting your interest inside an S corporation would not work. The regulations tell us, again, that won't work. They don't tell us a whole lot about why it doesn't work. And I have a feeling these regulations will get challenged in court when they go final, but I also don't see the service backing off that position. One thing they did put in here, though, that was kind of nice if you're in real estate, and in fact, then, but it kind of raises the question about why real estate partnerships are in the mix if you interpret it this way. They are not going to count net 1231 gains under the three-year rule. A net 1231 gain may be treated like a capital gain, but it's not a capital gain, so the IRS decided that that would not impact it. That basically defangs the carried interest rules for most partnerships where you'd use a carried interest. Obviously, it still causes problems for partnerships that have lots of investment assets, but there obviously are ways that could be managed. So we'll do that. You know, take a look at that's out there again. Now, I decide of these three packages, among the people that listen to this podcast, most likely the most direct impact will be the small business accounting method and potentially the syndicate rules, because that's what could bring some small partnerships into the 163J rules. And so, you know, I'm going to think that a lot of us are dealing with entities that have less than $25 million of revenue, at least that are structured as entities that are going to be worried about the syndicate rules and other rules. And, you know, so if you're not in that, if you're in a highly leveraged business that has higher revenue, then yeah, these rules are there. But those rules, like I said, were not really changing very much from the proposed regs. In a lot of areas, they did modify the definition of interest, somewhat more taxpayer friendly there, some other issues, and also carried interest. That's for the most part specialized in certain industries, and having defanged the real estate side of the equation, my guess is that probably most people listening to this are not terribly deep in that, though if you are, you want to go look at it. So we're going to talk about the small business accounting method proposed regulations for the most part this week, because I think there's a lot of interesting things in there, And we're going to talk about some of the stuff they added or clarified here that I think is really important. Now, those proposed regulations, it's Regulation Project 132766-18. The IRS formally announced they were doing it on July the 29th. I don't believe it has yet been published in the Federal Register. I think the Federal Register has announced they are going to publish it. But the IRS, all three of these regs were, interestingly enough, issued in a way the IRS doesn't normally do it. But that is, they posted the regs on their website first before they were announced as coming into the Federal Register. So we didn't get a pre-publication version of the register. That's usually what we see. So they're telling us right away, before they have a date of publication, these are our regs. This may have to do with the fact that under COVID-19, they're not sure how quickly the Federal Register is going to be able to process everything. And they want to get these out. I'm guessing that's probably a large chunk of it, because traditionally they have not put these in the directory they're using. The directory they're using for this now is a directory normally they put in things like, you know, the stuff they publish directly. Revenue rulings, revenue procedures, notices, announcements, that kind of stuff. Now we're seeing these come in there. So these regulations apply to those special rules that a small business can do to make use of the cash basis of accounting without worrying about any of the other restrictions on use of the cash basis of accounting, to allow the small business to ignore the uniform capitalization rules of 263 Cap A, what we all love to refer to as UNICAP. So those are out of the mix. By the way, as I said when this law came in, I cannot imagine anybody eligible to opt out of UNICAP not opting out of UNICAP, because UNICAP takes, you know, full absorption costing and takes it to whole new levels. It's, you know, it's not anything GAAP does. It's not like anything. It was just a way they needed to raise money back in the 80s. They put these rules in. It's really one of those things where if you can opt out, you opt out. They also have the right to opt out of 471A's rules for inventory. You have to use special rules, and we'll talk about those in 471C. We have two choices. We'll talk about that regs, because there's some interesting guidance there as well as to how we interpret the issues, especially the alternative. Well, both the materials and supplies option, we have some interesting guidance there that goes against the Blue Book. And we also have, under the non-materials and supplies, we have some interesting things I think you got to read carefully as a warning that this is not carte blanche to be able to get rid of your inventory. So we'll talk a little bit about that. They also cover the small contractor rules under Section 460. I didn't find a whole lot in there that wasn't just cleanup. A lot of this reg is just simply revising references and totals and numbers, you know, to deal with the fact it's not 10 million but 25 million, or it's not 5 million for cash basis but 10, you know, or I should say 25. So a lot of it is simple cleanup regulations. So I really didn't see anything in the small contractor rules that was anything but just rotating the numbers from 10 to 25, and actually inflation adjusted 25. So we go those. Now, these are proposed regulations, but the regulations make it very clear that a taxpayer can rely on this. So that's good news. You know, in essence, if you want to, you can use this. Now, the fact that it is proposed does mean that you could at least argue for another position. And as long as your position is reasonable, you should be able to support it. But I think whenever you have a case like this, you have to tell your client, the IRS is not going to challenge us if we go with the proposed regulations. If you're going outside of it, that's acceptable if it's reasonable. But the client does need to know it is a higher risk position. Remember, you know, the mere fact it's not, you know, you don't isolate from the client the fact that your position, you know, that one position is a higher risk than another. You don't take a position just because the IRS would never challenge it, even though it's dead wrong. That's definitely violates the statements on standards for tax services. That violates the preparer penalty rules under the IRS. It violates under the IRC. You know, it's a huge violation problem all over the place, can get you in trouble. But once you've decided that two positions are acceptable, it is perfectly acceptable. And in fact, I would say it's probably your duty to discuss with the client the relative exposures of both positions. If you take a position based on the proposed regs, then essentially the agent's going to have to back down or claim or argue with you at least over how you applied the reg, as opposed to the fact that the reg's position doesn't reflect the law. So understand that position. Now, the first thing we want to talk about here is the tax shelter rule. And, well, we're going to get there. The real catch is all of these things depend on a business meeting to, you know, having two qualifications. First, it has to be able to pass a gross receipts test. If your gross receipts on average over the past 3 years are above a certain level, in this case, and we'll talk about how that level's set, but if it's above that level, you're not allowed to use any of these methods. So that's key. And this is also cross-referenced under 163J for the small taxpayer relief from the 163J business interest rules. So first thing is we have to figure out, are we below the limit? Now the limit in the TCJA was $25 million, but it's inflation adjusted. So for 2020, we're looking at $26 million. $26 million is our limitation that we follow, you know, and that limitation was put in place. Essentially, that's our annual limit on receipts. Now, the aggregation rules are discussed, and in essence, if you have a bunch of related companies, you can't just, which some people might decide to do, well, since I've got $60 million of revenue, what I'm going to do is I'm going to just divide the company into three pieces. Maybe we operate in the state of Arizona, and maybe I can divide myself. They're all below $25 million. So I would do a, like, you know, East Valley portion, Maricopa County, you know, eastern part, West Valley and other parts, Maricopa County, and then do rest of state. And potentially, if I divided that way, everyone might be below $25 million. Well, they're saying, now we're not going to let you pull that stunt. You do have to aggregate. The aggregation rules are ones we're kind of used to. They're under Section 52, which is the jobs credit aggregation rules we've been using for years. And also 414, which is the qualified retirement plan aggregation rules. That's what we knew all along would be our aggregation systems. We also know, just like before, you annualize short years. Because, by the way, those aggregation rules, I should say, they were there before when this limitation was $5 million and applied primarily to C corporations, that they could use the cash basis only if they were below $5 million. Once they were above, they had to use something else. So this was how we did that. We did those aggregations the same. So those are the same. And if you don't have 3 years, let's say you use how many years you have, prior years, and if one of those years is less than 12 months, which probably will be if you just started the business one of those years, you annualize that year and then use that. Now, the definition of gross receipts, it's found in the 448 regulations, right? We get those things. And what it tells us gross receipts are in this issue is essentially, you know, tells us how those are. They're what we recognize for business items for the year. And we don't worry about things like, we talk about those things. We talk about those issues, right? The determination of gross receipts from a temporary reg for like a corporation is kind of retained the same. It's still everything. When you get to individuals, though, instead of having them in the Section 448 regs, the gross receipts calculations are found in an individual test. That's found in a separate regulations under 263 Cap A. And what they tell us there is that essentially for the S corporations, right, we just don't worry about things that aren't income, business income to the individual. So we're not going to worry about those other items. Similarly, if your individual owns an interest in a partnership or an S corporation, they have to pick up their share of the gross receipts from the partnership or S corporation in doing this $26 million test. That had to be added because previously none of this mattered because, again, this was a C corp only test in 448. We didn't worry about non-C corps. So you're going to find the C corp part of the definition, shall we say, in 448. You're going to find in the regulations outside of an overall method of accounting. You're going to find, and remember, we're not going to do the individual's overall method of accounting is not really tied to this, to their overall of income anyway. It's tied to their business income. So, and the method of accounting goes with the business. So we have a little bit different there. So that's why those are found in a different location. There are some examples. They are printed in the manual, I should say in the materials we've got this week. Okay, 26 million, that's probably not the test that was bothering you for the most part. Obviously, if you're in partnerships, have a lot of related parties, you probably have been beating the heck out of the aggregation rules. And, you know, that didn't change. It's still the same as it's always been. And that aggregation will still come into play. So this part, really nothing major except some clarifications of how individuals handle it, you know, and that we have to, we can ignore their investment income, but we have to pick up their business income flowing through from a partnership or S-corp. By the way, when I say business income, that will include from a passive activity, because passive activities can still be business. That does not, I know you may think of them as investment, your client may think of it as investment, but the reality is passive activities generally by definition are business items. So yeah, that's kind of what it is, because the other starts called portfolio in that standpoint. Now, let's talk about the issues, right? Cash basis of accounting. Okay, we'll talk, we're gonna talk about the tax shelter rule here. Okay, this is found in here, and this is probably one of the more significant issues in this thing. What's a tax shelter? Because first thing is gross receipts, so you have to be below 26 million of gross receipts in 2020 for the prior 3 years, average for the prior 3 years. But number two, you cannot be a tax shelter. And so this provides, this applies not just in 448, which is where it's discussed because that's where you see the reference. But that 448 definitions, those are both cross-referenced by a lot of other provisions. All of the accounting method provisions cross-reference there too. So if you're a tax shelter, even if you're below $26 million, you're not exempt from 263 Cap A. If you're a tax shelter, you're not allowed to do the skip the 471A inventory rules. If you're a tax shelter, right, you're not allowed to use the small business accounting, you know, for 460 for a contractor, and you're not allowed to use the cash basis of accounting at all if you're a tax shelter. So they're there. But again, the big one is this applies to the business interest rules. And the reason why that's huge is because when we get to the definition of a syndicate, you're going to find that a lot of what I'll call small and medium-sized real estate partnerships, where you have a promoter getting money from investors to go, you know, buy a building or whatever, so setting up all these projects, those are going to look like a tax shelter when we get done with this. I think a lot of them are going to fail under the syndication rules. So we'll talk about that here very quickly, how that's going to happen. Now, there are three categories of tax shelters, and two of them we can probably get rid of pretty quickly that we're going to not be our major concern. One, if you're not a C corporation and you have to register either with the federal government or state government, register your security. Okay. Now, there's a special exception for certain limited cases of S corporations that have to register for certain details. But by the way, they do make clear in the regs that, you know, if you have to register to, you know, if you're one that is exempt from the general rules, but you have to file a notice to be exempt, that filing of notice will count as registration for this purpose. You'll be a tax shelter. You also cannot be what's called, what they actually, the law just calls it a tax shelter, which is funny, because that would seem somewhat circular. I will tend to refer to it as a 6662 shelter, right? Under 6662, because that's the reference they're going to go to. And finally, we're going to talk about this thing called a syndicate. Okay. Now, like I say, for most of us, our concern is going to be the second and third, and probably not the second, although I'll give a little bit of history as to why maybe you might think you should freak over number two, because you were freaking over this definition before and putting lots of disclaimers on letters because you thought everything you did was that. I would suggest you may want to revisit your belief that everything fits that definition, because the IRS doesn't believe it. I've never believed it, but a lot of people putting disclaimers on everything seem to believe it. So we'll get back to that. And then we'll talk about the third category. The third category to me is the big problem. And it's been since day one, and the AICPA recognized that as well, that if that's applied as the law is written, which unfortunately kind of the IRS has to apply things as the law is written, but the AICPA was trying to persuade him there was some way they could have carved something out. IRS clearly didn't go down that path, the context of a syndicate, because that's the third category in the law. Now, so we have the basics there. Now, a 6662 shelter, I probably should give you the definition there. That's defined as a partnership or other entity, an investment plan or arrangement, or an other plan or arrangement if a significant purpose of such partnership, entity, plan or arrangement is the avoidance or evasion of federal income tax. Well, you know, here's our problem. A lot of you, you may remember that exact language used to be in CERC 230. And when it got put in, people started putting these disclaimers on everything. I saw a disclaimer on an RIA explanation of a tax law, which to me was like, that's clearly not what this refers to. And I had noticed it didn't do it again. But, you know, it was like, it got just wild. We'd slap that on anything. You know, hey, do you want to have lunch today? You can't rely on this guy's penalties. It's like, come on, guys, you're slapping on way too many things. Now it's gone. That's gone from CERC 230 anyway. And even when it was there, generally it was being way overused. I mean, everybody just slapped it on everything. And as I've explained to people, I could understand why, if I was in charge of the tax practice for an international accounting firm, I'd do it, because I'll be blunt, I can't trust every partner, right? But I'm being held accountable. So yes, I'm going to force that in on every document anybody puts out, because I don't trust my partners. But if you're a sole proprietor, you don't trust your partner, who the only partner is you? That seemed difficult. You know, that's kind of the problem. Note, I'm not saying that the average partner in an international firm is going to violate those rules. They won't. But the problem was, you were exposed to one rogue partner. And when you're that big, assuming there are no rogue partners in any office anywhere in the country is just an assumption that if I was the managing guy, I would, you know, if I was in charge of the tax practice, there's no way I'd want to make that assumption. You know, unless I'm able to review in detail the work of every one of them and approve or throw them out, which they're not going to give me that power. So yeah, that'd be why we'd do it. Well, let's talk about this thing called a syndicate. What is a syndicate, and why is it such a problem? And why did the AICPA get so worked up about it? Okay, well, let's talk about this. What is a syndicate? A syndicate is, very simply, a partnership or other entity, right, other than a C corporation, if more than 35% of the losses are allocated to. Now be careful, we'll get to this rule. Allocated is what they're going to say in the reg. The law actually says allocable, but allocated is a much nicer structure. 448 regs have always used allocated. The IRS always says treat as allocated. And we'll talk about why that's important, but let's get to our definition. So our losses are allocated to a limited partner or a limited entrepreneur. Now, a limited partner, we know who that is. What is this thing called a limited entrepreneur? That's going to be our problem category. So our first test, though, is we take a look at our flow-through entity. And if we have a loss for the year, so it's only going to apply to the year we have a loss, where we're going to worry about this, where we could trip this definition. But if I have a loss, then if more than 35% of that loss is going to the category of my equity holders that are either limited partners, well, I'm a limited partnership, that's going to be simple. I know who those people are. Or this category called limited entrepreneurs, which is the definition I got to look at. But if I've got more than 35% going there, it's a mechanical test. I am a syndicate. I'm a tax shelter. I have just lost the option to use any of the small business accounting methods. And more importantly, very importantly, I've lost the ability to get out of the 163J rules. Now, if I'm a real estate partnership, I could still get out, but I'd have to make that election to be an electing small business partnership. And as we know, if I make that election, that's permanent and forever, or at least kind of forever. I know we have that special relief provision the IRS has put out for the special 2 years, and we're not talking about that here today. But yeah, but basically, at least from 2021 going forward, it would be a permanent forever election. So if we ever had a loss and we're a real estate partnership, and we don't want to be limited in our interest deduction, we'd have to go to ADS depreciation on everything and never be able to not use it, that at least on all real property. Now, limited entrepreneur is somebody who has an interest other than his limited partner. Well, that's kind of a duh, because limited partner is already in. So what's the real definition? They do not actively participate in the management of the activity. Now, this is kind of not cross-referenced to 469, but we kind of do it. And I should add Section 1256, which has this definition, has a list of categories of cases where you're deemed to materially participate. So we do have some options there that get around that. But the general rule is in your average real estate partnership where I've got a promoter who, you ever notice promoter would never have enough money to do it, right? So the promoter has put in, you know, 5% of the capital, right? But they're the only manager. They run everything. It's an LLC. And all the other money came in from investors. And those 95% people that came in that way, they put their money in. And we're assuming we didn't have to register this thing. But they put their money in. They don't do anything with the deal. You know, when they do that, we have a syndicate if we have losses. And of course, your average real estate structure has been structured and pushed from the beginning that, oh, yeah, we have losses in all the years we're operating the rental part of it, but then we make a ton of money the last year we sell everything. Okay, great. Now, these rules have been around before, but to be frank, I talked with some people who do real estate partnerships, and like they said, everybody worried much about them. We kind of ignored them. And it was because, well, the worst the IRS could do in the past was put you on the accrual basis. And to be frank, a person I know that does a lot of work with real estate partnerships said, you know, I might not mind being on the accrual basis. So it was like I didn't really care. And the IRS didn't really push the matters. Now suddenly it's important. The big importance is 163J, but it's also important if you've got an operating partnership that has a lot of passive investors, you know, people that are just putting money in, that also can cause you to get the 163J rule. So again, you're going to worry about that with highly leveraged, et cetera, but also for these other benefits, okay? Now, key. So here's the catch. So our syndicates, we know what it is. We look at that. Now, how do we determine the loss? 163J creates a problem. Because remember, if my interest expense, if I am a tax shelter, then my interest deduction is limited to 30% of taxable income. Well, you know, of adjusted taxable income. Now, if the reason I have a loss is because I'm heavily leveraged, once you limit me to 30% of adjusted taxable income, which is basically taxable income before interest, I'll no longer have a loss. So then arguably, well, I wouldn't be a syndicate anymore. Okay? But then you go back and say, aha, but as soon as I do that, I get the whole deduction. Now I have a loss, I'm a syndicate. Okay, the back and forth. It's like IRS resolves that in these regulations. What the IRS tells us in this point, we look at this losses, we kind of ignore 163J. Okay? We're going to basically not worry about the 163J limitations. We're just going to take the full deduction of interest. If a full deduction of interest would give us a loss for the year and that loss would be allocated more than 35% to the people who are limited entrepreneurs or limited partners, then we are a tax shelter. And these rules will come in place. And unless we make the election, if we're a real estate partnership or a farming partnership, to escape these rules, to take the ADS depreciation for the classes of assets we have to do that on, we're going to get nailed with the 163J limits, or we got to make that bad election that's permanent. Okay. Now, you should note, you could move in and out of the status over time. And that's not necessarily, you know, like I said, here's the problem. So I start out, right? I have 10 years of income. I'm looking good. But in year 11, something happens and we end up with a loss in year 11. In year 11, I will become a syndicate and that will kick me immediately out of all these benefits and immediately into 163J. Okay, that's a problem that we have. Now, because of that, the IRS said, oh, okay, we'll at least let you get some warning. So you can irrevocably elect to use the prior year's, you know, allocation to determine if you're a shelter. So if we didn't have a loss in 19, we're going to have a loss in 20. I can say I'm still not a shelter for 20. But here's the problem. That's an irrevocable election. So that means in 21, I will be a shelter. I have no option. So I know I'm going to lose the benefit, but I'd lose it next year, not this year. That's actually fairly nice because otherwise planning would be a disaster. You'd go, uh-oh, we're going to lose money. We're going to be a shelter. you know, and we're going to be doing stuff, but you're still going to want to plan, because if you could avoid that loss, you're going to want to avoid that loss. Now, the interesting flip side of it, though, which really gets to a weird side, is you do realize on exam, the IRS might be looking to throw you into a loss. The agent might be ahead by giving you a loss for the year that would then cause you to become not eligible to get these benefits in the year in question, because if you didn't think you had a loss, you didn't make this election, so it'd be immediate. And it could create some real interesting problems on exam. So that would be a real issue, right? You cannot, and by the way, if you become a tax shelter, you lose the right to use all those benefits, right? What they say is, we're not going to let you automatically reelect the next year. You have to wait at least 5 years if you've been a shelter, and you're going to need the IRS's permission to go back. The IRS says they don't want something that's going to be coming in and out of shelter status, jumping in and out of cash basis, jumping in and out of 471A, jumping in and out of 163J. So they're going to specifically require you to get permission if you want to restore any of those benefits, and you cannot get that permission for 5 years. So yeah, if you become a syndicate, we got a problem here. And by the way, even if you got out of it under the syndicate rules with 163J, that ADS depreciation, apparently you'll still survive. That election is going to stay put, even if you are now not subject to J. That's one of the problems with that one being a permanent option. Okay. Now, let's talk about this in a little more detail. Well, we talked about that. I duplicated that, unfortunately, so I'll skip that. Those of you watching on the screen, on the slide. Right. Now, if you want to make this election, you have to make the election to use the prior year on a timely filed return. So you cannot make this election on an amended return. You cannot make this election if you don't file on time. So if you're going to make that election to use the prior year's income, it has to be on the timely filed alone return. No late election, no amended return. And that's key, because it means if the agent comes in on exam and discovers you had a loss that year, right, you cannot say, I want to go ahead and make the election now. Because they could discover you have a loss, and that would seem bad, right? Because you're going, no, they're not going to get a refund, because that having a loss could trigger 163J. Because remember, we ignore 163J in terming a loss. So you could still have an increase in an assessment of tax by the agent showing you had a loss that year if we don't consider 163J. So again, if you're going to want to do the prior election, it must be on the original return, not the amended return. And once you do it, yeah, we don't let you out, right? That'll be key. Now, cash basis, there are some changes in the regs there for cash basis of accounting. This transferred over from the old corporate rule. Used to be, once a C corporation went over the revenue limits, you could never go back to cash basis. That has been pulled because 448 no longer has that requirement. So we don't have to worry about that. If you go over 26 million, right? But then, you know, 5 years later, 6 years later, you go under again on average, you can go back to cash basis. It's not a permanent bar forever, right? Okay. Now, if you go over 26 million, so let's say we finish up here 2020. So we know that for the prior 3 years, which would be 17, 18, and 19, that average was under $26 million. But now we discover 2020's numbers are such that we're going to go over. Well, that means in 21, we have to change our method of accounting on 21 return. We don't get any option. It's changed immediately. Also means, right, all of that things gets lost immediately. If we want to change back to the cash basis, generally, if you wait 5 years, you can do it. But if you don't wait 5 years, if you want to do it earlier, you would have to get the IRS permission. They will allow you. And that permission is going to be, unfortunately, asking for a private letter ruling, right? Not exactly cheap, right? So we're going to end up doing that. Now, the more interesting part of the regs, I think, comes under the inventory side. That's where we got some interesting guidance that tells us things we didn't know before. Remember, the special rule 471A, if we're below that $26 million, we're not a tax shelter, we could ignore the 471A full-blown standard inventory rules and instead use one of two other methods. And this quite often will be along with our election to use the cash basis of accounting. We can go the non-incidental materials and supplies method. Treat our items that previously were inventory as if they were non-incidental materials and supplies. Or we can instead elect to use the method used in our Apple financial statement, if we have one, the AFS. Or if we don't have an AFS, what we do in our books and records. Now, this option has caused a lot of discussion. I've seen posts everywhere. I've seen articles about trying to get your inventory to zero. You know, does this allow us to zero the inventory? There were two major theories about how we got there using this. Number one, the idea was, well, incidental materials and supplies, that's materials and supplies. The regulations under 263 little a have this de minimis rule that if you make the election applies to all of your non-incidental supplies, and it says if the invoice costs below $2,500, let's say, and we don't have an AFS, we're able to write those off as long as that's what we do on our books and records. Other side said, and if we have an AFS, we have to not do that on our Apple financial statement. That's far less likely to work. So we have that option, right? So we do that. Or, you know, we do the same thing there. We say, no, we're going to elect our books and records method. And even if it's above 5,000, whatever, we're just not going to capitalize anything on our QuickBooks. We don't have an AFS. Again, with an AFS, you're probably going to be forced to capitalize because your auditor is going to be a little bit upset about not capitalizing inventory. But if you don't have one, the idea was, well, we get to zero that way. So we're two zero theories. These regulations effectively shoot down both zero theories. So let's talk about what the regs tell us. Okay, if you decide to go the non-incidental materials and supplies, and this was borrowed from the IRS's, you know, cash basis. If you're below a million, anybody could do it. If you're below 10 million of average revenues, you could do it. If you weren't a C corporation and you weren't in certain industries, but you had to treat what would have been inventory as materials and supplies. That's always been the old rev ruling. They borrowed that to put that in this law. Well, you could treat it as non-incidental or supplies, right? And what that means is, you know, we'd put it that way. Now, if you have non-incidental materials and supplies, you do capitalize them, but you write them off when they are used, okay? Now, the question becomes, when are they used? So let's say I buy this stuff, you know, I've got this stuff, and I'm a manufacturer, so I buy this raw material. Let's say I'm a bakery. I buy flour, right? Butter, you know, eggs, milk, etc., raw materials. Well, then I go into the bakery and I take that milk, I take some of the eggs, you know, I take some of the flour, and I make the cake. Is that using the supply? The IRS decided that for this purpose, that's not using. To use the flour, it has to finally be in something delivered to the customer. So baking the cake will not be using the flour. Rather, for purposes of being able to write off the cost of that much of the flour, rather, we will have to actually sell the cake to a customer. When the customer buys the cake, then I can take the cost of the flour, the eggs, the milk, etc., and direct labor, and put that on my P&L, you know, put down my tax P&L. Okay. You're going to find out, wait, that, especially for a manufacturer, that looks a lot like 471A inventory. Yeah, really sort of does, doesn't it? It doesn't look like you're going to save that much by doing it. Now, what about that de minimis election problem though? Because, you know, I'm probably paying less than $2,500 even for my big bags of flour. I'm not paying $2,500 a piece for them. Does the minimum selection solve the problem? Answer, no. The IRS and the regulations say the de minimis election will not be allowed to be used on these deemed materials and supplies. For purpose of de minimis election, they're still considered inventory. The de minimis election does not apply to inventory. You cannot use the de minimis election to treat these deemed supplies as basically being expense when purchased. Doesn't matter what your books and records say, I don't care. You cannot do that, right? That's going to be the key issue. Also, they clarify in the regs, you pretty much have all the standard good old 471A cost flow assumptions. You want to use them for how things come in and out of these non-incidental materials and supplies. You could use FIFO, average cost, the standard sort of issues. Okay. Now, like I said, if you are like a retailer, probably not that big a deal. Let's say I'm a retailer. I'm selling, you know, computer peripheral equipment. I get in an order of 60 scanners. and I sell 20 of them to a customer, yeah, that's use. And it's not use until I do. And that was kind of how to treat it. But if I'm a manufacturer, I still need a lot of systems behind me. Not much of a benefit here for a manufacturer. Now let's go to the, if we want to go the other option, right? This is what we call our 471C methods. And we have two of them. We have the AFS 471C method and the non-AFS 471C method. Now, the AFS is Apple Financial Statements. That's the financial statements we've always been used to, as you know, under the AFS rules, which means you start out first, you have a GAAP financial statement that's filed with the SEC, you have a GAAP financial statement that's audited for a significant non-tax purpose, or do you have a GAAP financial statement that's filed with the federal government, a federal agency, other than the SEC or the IRS. Okay. If you don't have one of those, then we go with IFRS statements, same three tests, right? If we do that, right? We'll have those, right? And, you know, and if a financial statement other than a return, right, filed with this, all those issues, you know, those others filed with the, you know, with a state agency, et cetera, can be involved in the mess. We have issues there. So we have these specific rules, right? Fine. That's there if it's covered. Now, if you have one of those, this is your only option if you don't go for materials and supplies. You have to go for the 471C method if you don't want to go materials and supplies, and you're going to want to use this special, I don't want to use 471A. That's your option. It ties to the reporting in the Apple financial statement. So generally, whatever has been capitalized in the AFS is capitalized for tax purposes. What you write off to expense is written off with a caveat. If there are other tax provisions besides 471A that delay the deduction, you know, it's going to delay it. So if you've not yet met the all events test on this item, you're not allowed to write it off yet, even though, you know, it would be otherwise allowed. So if some other provision of the code other than 471A, you know, denies or delays the deduction, that deduction is still denied or delayed. Now, the more interesting method always was for most of our clients, the non-AFS 471C method, because our clients did not have an Apple financial statement. And this, again, is the only method you've got option if you don't want to go materials and supplies, you're trying to get a 471A. Okay, standard rule. You follow whatever the taxpayer uses on their books. So far, so good. I mean, that sounds great. So basically, we take a look at what they're doing on QuickBooks. And if they charge everything to an expense account, we're fine, right? Not so right. The one big problem we've got here is the regulations specifically say that this method must properly reflect the entity's business activities for non-tax purposes. So you've got to have a non-tax use of this information that is significant, and actually it may be all of the non-tax uses of information, that don't ever treat this stuff as capitalized, right? Treat it as currently expensed. That means if you go around and you, let's say, do a special, you know, you charge everything off that expense account, but then the end of the year you have your, you know, you put together a financial statement, it's going to be reviewed for the bank. And on that, you know, we do an adjusting entry to take that stuff out of the expense account, move it up on the balance sheet as inventory. Tough luck. Doesn't work. Right? You've got to do that. Secondly, even if you don't do that, you still got to be able to show that it properly reflects the activities. The IRS can still attack it. So if you do take those $50,000 items of inventory, and you just write them off when you buy them, even though they may sit in your inventory for 3 years, you know, they don't move very quickly, IRS is going to say that doesn't properly reflect your business activities. And they're going to be able to deal with that. So, yeah, it renders it somewhat less useful. And in fact, the IRS has some examples in the regulations, proposed regs, that we have in our materials for this week. If you download those from the website, or you just go read the article we post on the website, and they have an example that directly goes after that issue, right? You know, you gave information to other people for borrowing or other purposes that reflect that as inventory. Tough luck. I don't care. Your books don't reflect it. You're putting out financials that do. So tough luck. Okay. Now, we do have some 263A revisions. They're pretty minor. They did remove the small reseller exemption from the regulations because it really doesn't apply anymore. It used to be if you were a reseller, you weren't a manufacturer. If you had less than $10 million of revenues, you'd have to use 263 Cap A. Obviously, if you're a small reseller and you have less than $26 million of revenues, or if you're a manufacturer with $26 million of revenues, it doesn't matter. So they got rid of that. They did have to do some special changes because certain things cross-reference that rule. So they did make some changes to fix places where that other test was cross-referenced, where the numbers would still apply. So they make some references there as to how they're going to handle those. They noticed that this is something that some people might have been concerned about. They said, well, we know this counts for inventory, but what about those things like capitalization of interest? You know, the 263 Cap A talks about that for the, you know, a capitalization of interest on self-constructed assets, the avoided cost rules when you had to deal with those. Yeah, if you opt out of this, you also remove 263A, you remove those 263A rules as well. So that could be really helpful. And they also did some cleanup and some special options for farming trades and businesses. I'll reference them in the materials. Won't spend much time here because that's, you know, more specialized industry. But they did do some stuff and did some basic cleanup there. Okay. Now, like I say, the big takeaway from this is take a look at the tax shelter rules. That's especially important for the interest for those of you who have real estate operations, because I think that's the thing that's most likely to trip it, that we did not get syndicate relief. Underline, boldface, flashing lights, no syndicate relief, right? If you're not in real estate, that may not affect you as often because usually most of our companies, most of our businesses are all active participant owners. So it may not be the big a problem otherwise. But the other thing is if you're doing the 471A rules and you're trying to say, well, I want to get out of that inventory, yeah, take a look at the rules they gave us. It may not be as nice a deal or as good a deal as you might have thought it was, unless you're going cash basis of accounting. And this is just kind of enables cash basis by gives you a way to get rid of the inventory problem. Because again, you don't get rid of the inventory problem, you have to be on the cash, you have to be accrual basis under 471. So normally, if you're going to make the cash basis election, you've got to make the 471A inventory election, and that tells you how you'll handle it to get the cash basis otherwise. Now, the final thing I want to discuss this week is not in the regs, but the IRS put out an interesting piece of information, again, on their frequently asked questions on their website because, hey, that's where everything's going. So the website tells us they published on the website a temporary procedure to fax automatic consent forms 3115 due to COVID-19. It went up on July the 29th. And this change impacts anytime you have to file a form 3115 for an automatic change, automatic permission to change a method of accounting. Right. Most times that's how we're going to do it for accounting methods, because we're going to fit under the automatic method change, including any of the changes that we just discussed would be a 3115. You file it at 844-249-8134. That began on the 31st of July. So we're past that date now. You should be faxing those things in. Now, if you have recently mailed one in, don't also fax it. They don't want to have both the fax and the mailed version. If you mailed it in prior to the 1st of August, right? You know, mailed it in prior to that date, don't worry about it. Just go with it. They do tell us exactly what has to be on our cover sheet, which I find interesting. So the cover sheet's supposed to have a subject line that says Form 3115, have the sender's name, title, phone number, and address, the taxpayer's name, the date, and the number of pages, including the cover sheet. The IRS will not provide, and this is, I consider to be very concerning, the IRS will not provide any sort of fax confirmation or receipt to you. Remember, when we did these by mail, we used certified mail to prove timely filing. Now they're saying, well, just keep your fax log. Yeah, I'm concerned about that. I mean, because if the IRS disputes 20 years down the line, you ever filed this thing, and you don't have the certified mail receipt. And again, my concern is things like that. Hopefully 20 years from now, I will not be in practice, right? We'll see. You know, I'm hoping that I don't, you know, not in practice in 20 years and that's your problem. But there will be businesses that are in business 20 years from now, because I've got clients been in business 20 years. They may very well have filed a change at this point. They may be changing because we got these regs. You're going to have to prove you filed the 3115. Now, this is going to be an agent then, because they're going to probably stop doing this once the mail gets fixed, who doesn't have any idea this rule was ever in place that you would fax it in. You better keep a copy of this web page, the IRS's thing to say, you know, keep the fax notice and that we were told not to mail them in. And then keep that as part of the permanent file, because you could need this any point in the future. The agent just wants to say, well, I don't think you had permission to go cash basis, so I think you're still accrual. That literally can be raised 20 years from now. It does not have to be done right away. And they also made clear this does not affect non-automatic accounting method changes. So if you're asking for permission and paying the fee, still file that as you always did. Do not fax that stuff in. Again, CPE is up and running. I want to remind you, if you're in New Jersey on August the 12th, I will be doing a four-hour webcast on the monthly update. And obviously, we've got these regulation projects to talk about, if nothing else. So I'll be doing that. So be sure to sign up on New Jersey Society's website. We'll talk about all these projects. I don't know if we're going to get a new law right now. Well, we're in kind of where I thought we'd be with the new law. And I know I'm kind of cynical on that. But my prediction was from day one that first the two parties would have to spend time, you know, telling you why it wasn't their fault. We don't have anything. This was all the fault of the other party because they totally fouled up and they're not cooperating. That's exactly where we stand these days. That's where we were as of Friday. As of Saturday, they finally got back together now to really decide maybe we should really do this. So they got together on Saturday, and now they say they're making progress, but they're not really close to a deal. My guess is somewhere over the next few days, we may actually see a deal. The real key is going to be to see if it passes, because as it is right now, my understanding is the conversations, I'm recording this on Sunday morning, the conversations right now are going on between the White House and the House. But the Senate is not in the loop in any way, shape, or form. The Senate has already, and we've got a concession that probably at well over 20 Republican senators will not vote for whatever comes out. You know, they wouldn't vote for the one that was proposed by the Republican Senate. You know, so yeah. So whether we get this through the Senate will be a lot more interesting than anything. I think there could be things will clear the House. And maybe the White House will go for, but how we cobble together the Senate, and more importantly, how you even get it to the floor for a vote, right? Just to get a vote in favor of it, since there are 57 Democratic senators, you know, there would have to be at least three Republicans that would vote for whatever the House passes that the White House is willing to sign, assuming that Vice President Pence would go and vote in favor of that, since the White House in favor of it, he'd vote for it, you know, to break the tie. But more importantly, we need 13 Republicans if we want to assure it can actually come to a vote. Because, again, you need 60 votes to bring something to a vote on the Senate floor. And that's the standard, quote, what we used to call the filibuster rule. It's not technically a filibuster anymore, but it's sort of referred to that way. Yeah, so I don't know if we'll get it or not. If we do, we will talk about that on the 12th broadcast for sure if there are tax provisions. So we'll see it. On August 13th, I'll be doing a session for Arizona on income taxation of trusts and estates, and we'll look at the Arizona Principal and Income Act as it involves that too there, so I'll be there. Arizona on the 14th, I'll talk about planning for the Qualified Business Income Deduction, Section 109 Cap A, that's an 8-hour session. And on Monday, the 17th of August, I'll be doing partnership taxation advanced issues. Again, all of those I just mentioned, the New Jersey ones and the ones in Arizona, they're all webcasts. There are no live sessions. Nobody's asked me to do a live session yet. So, you know, all of these are webcast. So the good news is you want to sit someplace, you know, you want to sit by yourself and you can be totally socially distanced from everybody and everything and take the course, or you could be sitting, I don't know, you know, maybe you're stuck in Tahiti. You want to take it, you got internet access, you can take it from Tahiti, you know, wherever you may be at, we can take the course. So think about doing that and think about signing up for those things. Again, live sessions, I don't know of any live sessions anywhere for the foreseeable future. And that's not just the ones that I'd be involved in. I just don't know of any. If you were looking for one, they're going to be very, very tough to find until this COVID-19 thing gets under a bit more control. So yeah, for the moment, we're going online. This has been Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of August the 3rd. Our posts online are at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com as always. Send questions or comments to me, Ed Zollers at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. I also, you can follow me on Twitter, I should say, at Ed Zollers is my handle there. I do follow discussions on State Society websites for Arizona, New Jersey, Minnesota, Washington, Illinois. So you can follow me there on their Connect sites for those societies. I also look in from time to time on CalCPA's Tax Talk site, so you can look in there. Now, all of them except California require you to be a member of that society to join. So if you're a member, you can look in. If you are, the Cal one is actually open to anybody anywhere across the country, so you can take a look in there if you want to, if you want to join there. If your state society has such a program to do a discussion group, I suggest you sign up there. You know, you sign up for their program because there'll be a lot of interesting things, that especially of local issues. If your state society does not sponsor such a program, then you want to take a look at CalCPA group and take a look there. And again, we'll be back next week, maybe with a new law, maybe not. We have no idea what's come there. We certainly probably be talking next week at least some more about what happened in the interest regulations. I'll take a little closer look at that next week. We'll have a little more discussion. Maybe talk a little bit about carried interest too. I don't know. It depends on what else happens in the week. But anyway, it's interesting time frame, and we'll see what happens. But otherwise, be sure to check back in here next week, and we'll keep you up to date here on current federal tax developments.